It's August 29th, 2011, and this is the Hell Yeah Show.
One of these days you're going to leave that in.
Hello and welcome to the Hell Yeah Show. I'm Alan.
I'm Emery.
And this is the show where we give you best practices for fail-free living. That's advice on how to not let technology ruin your day. Emery, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I had a pretty good weekend, and
I guarantee you I had a better weekend.
It sounds like it. from what you gave it quite a pretty good introduction earlier, and I'm pretty psyched to hear about your trip to PAX. But I also want to know how your new bag worked out.
My new bag. Yes. I'll add that to the show notes just to make sure I don't forget it, because I'm going to include that in the PAX discussion.
Okay.
I like that that's the part you're most excited about, though.
Yeah. Well, it is. It really is.
All right. PAX.
Tell me about all your PAX.
Yes. Yeah. PAX was this past weekend. PAX, for those who don't know or who didn't listen to the previous episode of this show, shame on you. PAX is a big gaming convention. All sorts of games, from board games to card games to video games to
Penny Arcade people, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's hosted by and put on by Penny Arcade, the webcomic turned just in general gaming society people. It's really good. It's just sort of a big celebration of gaming in its various forms. And it's kind of the antithesis of the sort of industry E3-like conference that you see where you have a bunch of big companies come and demo their stuff, and you have a bunch of usually journalists or other industry people come, and they are just trying to get through the day and see as much as they can. It's kind of the opposite of that. At PAX, you've got this really relaxed atmosphere. Everyone's there because they want to be there. And people will just take hours out of their day to sit around and play games with each other. They have big open tables everywhere where people sit down and play board games. They have massive rooms full of consoles and PCs where people can just sit down and play. And every booth has some sort of game that you can sample out. Every booth that involves some game will have a console there for you to just step up and play it for a bit. So it's a very relaxed atmosphere. It's I've never been to one before. It's a lot of fun. Everyone is super nice because, as I said, they just want to be there. They want to be nice to everyone else because everyone else is having a great time too. And you know, even if someone no one will complain about someone cutting in line or someone, you know, taking taking their spot or whatever. Like it's got such a great vibe to it.
And so there wasn't like, you know, a 12-year-old in the corner camping and sniping people. Usually what happens when I play video games.
Yeah. It is sort of the best of gaming culture condensed into a 3-day convention,
which is
really cool. So and they include stuff that you really wouldn't expect, stuff that didn't have to be there. They've got concerts on Friday and Saturday night, about 3 hours of concerts each night.
Oh, wow.
And there's this big theater in downtown Seattle right next to the convention center called the Paramount Theater. And it's where a lot of big musical acts, when they come to town, they play there. And they actually rented out that theater for all 3 days. And so all the big events would take place in this really beautiful concert hall like theater. And they ran a live D&D game, Dungeons and Dragons game, on the stage of this theater.
Lightning bolt! Lightning bolt!
which is just fantastic.
That's awesome.
The idea that sort of gaming has come into the sort of public view enough where you can rent out this theater, fill it with several thousand people, and play Dungeons and Dragons in front of this crowd on stage is pretty excellent.
See, now the problem with that, though, from my opinion, is that I don't really like the live action role playing thing. Like, I kind of think that the LARPing activity is kind of weird. Was it like that, or was it like people demoing how to? Because I this might come as a big surprise to you, but I actually have played Dungeons and Dragons before, and on several occasions. And I was wondering if it's like, you know, is it people in costumes being like that, or is
so?
It like,
so yes, the people who acted out are in costumes, but It's not what you think. I'd encourage you to go online and watch a YouTube video. Just search for PAX Dungeons and Dragons or something, and you'll probably find some video of this. Okay. It's so the four people that were playing, there were four players, and then there's the Dungeon Master. And the Dungeon Master is, I believe, the creative director at Wizards of the Coast, the creative director of Dungeons and Dragons.
They're a Hasbro company now, right? So they're on Rhode Island?
Are they?
Hasbro's in Rhode Island, and I believe that they own Wizards of the Coast.
That could be true. I don't know.
did they have funny New England accents?
So Chris Perkins has been around forever. I think he was around before Wizards of the Coast even bought the D&D license.
Got it.
But
because I was TSR back in the day, right?
Yeah. So he's probably one of the best dungeon masters out there. So he's there leading everybody through this game. And he's really good at it. He keeps things on a nice pace. He's very theatrical about everything. Perfect. But he kind of is just the...
Was he wearing like a big wizard hat?
He was wearing an Alice in Wonderland Mad Hatter style hat. But instead,
are you serious?
Yeah. But on the little sizing card, it said 666 or 6 6/6. Then the four people at the table, though, who were really the stars of the show, Chris Perkins was more of a facilitator. So the four people at the table were the two owners, hosts, the founders of behind Penny Arcade, which are Mike and Jerry or Gabe and Tycho. They're the basically the writer and the artist behind Penny Arcade. Both really funny guys. So that's fantastic. Then Scott Kurtz, who does PvP Online, another webcomic that they're pretty closely affiliated with. And also a pretty funny guy. And then Will Wheaton, who played... Do you know who he played?
Wesley Crusher.
Wesley Crusher on Star Trek The Next Generation, which we will unfortunately not be talking about this episode. Well, I would question that statement since you were the one that didn't watch your episode for this week.
Last week's episode was so terrible, I just couldn't bring myself to do it. I couldn't get them... I wanted to get Wood for it, but I just couldn't.
All right. Well, we will not be doing a Star Trek episode.
Did you get to meet Will Wheaton, though?
This week. I was actually stood behind Will Wheaton in a line to get food one day.
How does he smell? Did you smell him?
I did not smell him, no. He was wearing a cape, though, so that was pretty awesome.
Really, a cape?
Yeah.
Were you able to get a lock of his hair?
No, although people kept coming up to him for pictures and
I'm sure.
Yeah, and he kept saying he was having lunch with two enforcers who are the enforcers are the volunteers that help do all the security, line keeping, all that stuff.
At DEF CON they have them and they call them goons.
Yeah. But they're all super nice. They're happy to be there and happy to do that job. And so he was having lunch with two enforcers. So anyone who'd come up to him for a picture, he'd just say, "Now's not a good time. I'm having lunch with these guys here. Please, you know, find me another time." So
find me when I'm in 10 forward.
Yeah. So he was the fourth guy, and he's an actor, so he'd kind of ham it up a little bit. But so they all came out in costume. But it's not what you think. It's not they didn't come out in costume because they really want to nerd out about D&D. It's more they come out in costume for two reasons. One, because it's hilarious. They've all got these fantastically over the top costumes.
Yeah.
And there was actually they had bards, quote unquote bards.
Of course they did.
Yeah, which were Paul and Storm, who usually regularly opened for Jonathan Colton and who actually played on Saturday night. So they had Paul and Storm come out as bards and play little musical accompaniments and little improv one off songs along with various actions that would happen in the game. So it was all done very sort of pseudo theatrically, and. So they had Paul and Storm there. They were all in costume. And so one reason was it's hilarious. It was hilarious to see them come out in costume and so over the top and everything. The second reason is just it's kind of this statement of like gaming and Dungeons & Dragons specifically is enough in the mainstream now that these guys can come out on this stage in front of thousands of people, plus this video being posted online and everything, and you know, come out in these ridiculous costumes and just get applauded for it, you know, get lauded praise for doing this, that it's just kind of this compared to when D&D was this thing that you played with other people in a basement and never talked about, the fact that it's now something to be proud of, it's kind of this statement of that, right?
Well, at PAX anyway, right?
Right, yeah. Within this culture, sure. Although really, I have to say, anyone watching this video, it's hilarious not just because and entertaining, not just if you know how Dungeons & Dragons works and not just if you are in with that crowd. It's actually probably one of the better theatrical performances I've seen. They were all really, really good, and you know, all improv'd, right? But they were all had great comedic timing. It was actually really fun to watch and really engaging, just as sort of a story. They told a really good story and improv'd their parts really well, but also always with this kind of subtext of, look at how ridiculous this is. We're on stage in front of thousands of people doing this, right?
Yeah.
So it was just perfectly done, and probably my favorite event of the con. It was really, really, really well designed. So anyway, that is emblematic of the PAX experience, I think.
Right on.
Yeah. And there were great concerts. I didn't go to the concerts on Friday night because there was a panel that I wanted to go to. But I did go to the concerts on Saturday night. And it was Jonathan Coulton and Paul and Storm who opened for him, who were both just absolutely hilarious. And then Super Commuter, who I'd never heard of, and they were fine. And they went on last. So, but Jonathan Coulton was probably the big act.
Yeah, I would imagine. He's got a pretty big draw.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got a big big following and a big geek following as well, definitely. He wrote the ending song to the original Portal, so he mm-hmm. he's known well within the
He's a folk hero among nerds.
Yeah, exactly. overall, though, a lot of great panels. Went to a panel on video game data that was really fascinating. Went to a couple panels on specific games and a panel for a community that I'm part of, giantbomb.com, to just throw a plug for them out there. Went to their panel, went to browse the show floor a bit. Went to every round, almost every round, I missed one, of the Omegathon. Do you know what the Omegathon is?
I don't remember. I forget. I think I've heard of this before.
I don't know if I mentioned it last week or not, but it's basically they have somewhere around 20 people come and compete in an assortment of games, and they can be anything. It can be they've had skee ball one year. They've had this year they played Portal 2. They played let's see, Bananagrams. It's just a Mario Kart Double Dash. It's a random assortment of video games and non-video games, and these people are thrust into these without knowing how exactly the competition is going to work. and the grand prize is, I think, a trip to Tokyo, as well as $5,000 in prize money. And so you have these, I think there were six rounds of competition, each one a different game. And the final round was the original Legend of Zelda.
Oh, man.
And it was two people. It was down to two people by that point.
So it is dangerous for you to go alone. Take this.
They have these two people on stage, right? And they have no clue what the final round's going to be. All the other rounds are announced in advance. The final round is held until that moment on stage. These two competitors get up on stage. Uh-huh. They pull back this curtain, and there's two flat-screen TVs sitting there. They power them on, and the Legend of Zelda theme music comes on, and it's slightly desynchronized between both the TVs. You get like this echoing Legend of Zelda theme music, and the whole crowd goes nuts. Right? It was fantastic. And then the game boots up, and they say that, all right, the challenge here is to get the first section of the Triforce and be the first one to do that. So they're both basically playing through this game until they get past the first dungeon, and then the first person to do that is the winner and gets a trip to Hawaii and all that. And they actually had someone; they allowed them to have someone next to them reading from a game fac, from a guidebook for the game, basically, or and giving them step by step directions, although really chaotically, right?
Sure, why not?
Yeah. and so these two people right next to each other, it was great. They finished within seconds of each other, played Legend of Zelda on two TVs next to each other, again in front of thousands of people in this really, really beautiful auditorium. And that was the end of the show. That was the final note of PAX. So anyway, wow. quite a good convention, met lots of great people. Everyone's, as I said, just really nice and really happy to be there. It's definitely a lot of fun. So
it sounds like you had a blast.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very good. And a lot of people expressed that it should be a week long thing. Cause you balance going to all the panels and attending all the Omegathon rounds and all that with, just really wanting to sort of sit around and meet people and play games with people, which is actually a big part of the show, is just kind of chilling with other people who have similar interests and finding cool games to play. And so if there was a week where you could just kind of hang out with people and not worry about having to rush around all the panels and stuff, that'd be very cool too. Just having that really awesome community together and doing that for a few days would be fun in and of itself. But with the concerts added, the live D&D game, all the crazy events and everything, it was definitely a fun weekend. So, yeah. All right. Let's see. What else we got from this week? I guess you wanted to talk about Steve Jobs a bit, but we're gonna get to that a little bit later, right?
Yeah, were you gonna tell me about your bag or not?
Oh, my bag. Oh man. And Moo.com. I'm not even reading the notes anymore. Thank you for reminding me. So I want to know
how the Chrome Mini Metro worked out.
So my bag is the Chrome Mini Metro. I just bought it recently. Very nice
black,
bag.
A red with a red overlay, right?
Black with red, yes.
Yeah.
Very nice bag. Wait for it.
Okay.
Did not end up using it for all of PAX.
All right.
It doesn't have enough compartments for that use case specifically.
Oh, hold on a second.
Yeah.
Why do you say that?
Because for PAX, I'm bringing three portable game consoles, or three portable game systems. I'm bringing a couple decks of the metagame that I was talking about last week that I got printed from Moo.com. Bring granola bars, bring a bottle of water. There's a bunch of stuff that is just a lot nicer when I know I can reach into a specific compartment and pull it out of that compartment rather than the Chrome bag actually has like one large compartment and then a few. I think it's like maybe two smaller zipped up compartments, right?
Well, it has like the one in the front, which has and then like a big pocket and then a zipper pocket. But then there's also like the two little side pouches inside.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it was fine. But I actually so my main concern was I didn't want to bring my Timbuktu bag because it was so big. And actually, I found out that at least for this convention, a big bag was actually an advantage. I ended up getting a free OnLive micro console that they were just handing out to everyone. OnLive is the service that does sort of cloud gaming. I was wondering if
they were there for that.
Yeah, yeah. So you just plug this console into your TV, and you can play any game through or any game they offer through their service over the internet. And this thing is—it's not huge, but it's big enough that, in order to actually fit it in a bag, I was really glad that day I had brought my full Timbuktu bag, because otherwise this thing wouldn't have fit, and I'd be carrying around the separate bag, and so that would have been unfortunate. So just because you get so much swag and so many and you're carrying around so much stuff, actually a big bag was pretty advantageous, although in some of the more crowded lines, I had to be pretty careful about not whacking people with it. But the other thing
excuse me, swing it around.
The other thing about the Chrome bag, I'm not completely sold on the seatbelt idea. The seatbelt buckle.
Why do you hate the seatbelt?
I mean, I like it as a stylistic thing, but from
a practical standpoint,
it's kind of heavy, and when you unbuckle it, those things go sort of flinging around.
Well, hold on. See, okay, for what it's worth,
yeah,
I very rarely unbuckle mine.
Okay, okay.
Like, I use that adjusting strap.
Yeah.
And then when you release it by lifting up on it, and you get all that slack in the strap.
Right.
That gives me plenty of room to, like, loop it over my head. Like, I never take it off by hitting the button, mainly because I got stuff in there that's, you know, like a laptop or a camera or something that's going to be in my bag and I don't want to drop it.
Yeah.
But I hardly ever use the buckle. The buckle is a very rare occurrence for me.
So I will say, and this is by design, it's a very cycling-oriented bag. The way it fits on you, the size, all that stuff I'd imagine very good for a cycling commute, or for actually what I'll be doing in about a month now, back at school, biking around campus, that sort of stuff. So I do anticipate using it a lot for that, because it's smaller, but it still fits my 15-inch laptop. That sort of stuff I think is going to be really good. But actually, for a convention, it was not actually the bag I was looking for. So
That's unfortunate.
Yep.
I feel like I really let you down.
No, I made that choice on my own. You'd recommended the rickshaw, but
I thought that would be definitely more compartmentalized.
Yeah, but. Yeah. I'll tell you why I don't like the rickshaw commuter. It's those the water bottle holders on either side. Like this is gonna sound really nitpicky. It's the little I don't know how to describe them.
I've seen them. I know what they are.
Yeah, yeah. So on either side,
what do you like about them?
It's got those receptacles to hold water bottles. They make it look a little messier. They don't give it that nice, sleek, clean look that I'm looking for.
Oh yeah. See, well, what you might not realize is that they have like a little drawstring thing at the top, and so they're not like open and flapping around if you don't have anything in them.
Yeah, I mean it's more just sort of that there are these things hanging off either side of the bag. It's just a little messier than the look that I'm going for, because I'm so particular about my messenger bag. bag's appearance, clearly.
Look who you're talking to.
Yep.
I'm never satisfied, so I've got plenty of things that'll drive me nuts about something.
Anyway, but I'm now three bags and counting, so I may acquire one at some point anyway.
Hey, that's going to be great.
Yeah. All right. And then one other thing I wanted to mention with regard to PAX, Moo.com continues to be pretty ridiculous. So I had said last week that I'd ordered these cards from them, and there was a slight misprint. I actually got them, and they're cut a little unevenly. Or not unevenly, but they're cut in the wrong place, so the border's a little off. Mm-hmm. And so they reprinted them, and they rushed the reprint off to me. And I haven't actually opened the reprint up yet, but it was flagged as being defective as well. Like they miscut it as well. So they're sending me a third. They're sending me a third printing, which at this point is great, because these are actually sort of playing card like things. This is a deck of cards that I can use to play this game. So it's really great having three copies of it. But I wonder now if I'm just stuck in this infinite loop of a system where they're gonna where they're gonna keep sending me copies of this.
I think that's a possibility. Every issue that they make, and every time they print them, they're always damaged, and they're just going to keep printing you new ones until you're, drowning in them.
Yeah, yeah. Or if there's something with my file, the files I uploaded to them, that's causing them to be printed slightly off, and every time that happens, reprint them.
So what you're telling me is that they might have a quality assurance problem.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really blame them, and the cards actually look beautiful.
Yeah, you said they're fine.
And for all I know, the second batch of cards they sent me may be perfectly printed, and their supply system's just flagging it incorrectly.
Sure.
But I'm happy, because it was like 60 or 70 bucks to get the card, the original order, printed, and mm-hmm. I'm getting three times that, so I'm pretty happy.
Hey, way to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, all right. That's about enough for PAX. That was longer than I intended to talk about PAX, but it really was a pretty awesome experience. So I do recommend it. It sells out pretty quickly usually. So if it is something you're into, keep an eye out on Penny Arcade for when those tickets become available.
This was the PAX Pacific, right? So
yep.
The next one would be Boston.
Yeah, yeah. There's PAX one East. One PAX in Seattle, and there's one PAX in Boston. Each year, and they're actually talking about, someone asked at the Q&A, they said they're definitely thinking about having more, but they're not sure when or where. So
PAX Cabo.
I almost said Austin instead of Boston there, and it actually occurred to me Austin would be a great city for a third PAX.
It probably would be. It's good. It's centrally located, and it's a good convention town,
and there's actually quite a bit of video game development presence in Austin as well. I know BioWare is based out of there, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Anyway, all right, so that's PAX. moving on here,
yeah.
We have a very important topic to talk about here. and that is Emery's phobias. You've been looking to share your phobias with the audience since we started this show.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things about me that are kind of defective, and I think that this would be the perfect avenue for me to explore those things and discuss them a little bit
in front of dozens of our closest friends. Specifically,
there are dozens
one dozen.
Of them.
Yes,
there are dozens of them. Dozens. Yeah, there's a lot of them. I think this week we're going to start with food. I have a lot of food-related phobias. In particular, I'm afraid of foodborne illness and when water-based illness. Every once in a while, I'll hear sometimes they'll have like those stories where there's like they find something in the water and everyone's like supposed to avoid tap water. And for the longest time, I didn't have anything. I would never drink tap water.
So are you a bottled water guy or a filtration guy?
I used to be a bottled water guy, and then I also always had a Brita filter or something. But now I'm really pleased. I have we've got the Brita pitcher at home, and I fill up a big giant thing in the house that we shove in the fridge, right? Mm-hmm. And then sometimes I'll even go to if I'm at the co-op or something buying groceries, they'll have like a Culligan machine there, and I like those. Those are pretty great. But I'm way into these Camelback Groove bottles. Like the water bottle with the sippy top that you bite on and then you can just suck through it like a straw. And then it has a water filter in the stem and it's replaceable. So you can go to Amazon and you buy a 2-pack of these filters for $8 and you can drink tap water with impunity, which to be fair, I've actually been a lot better about this in the last couple of years. I used to be pretty, really sketchy about tap water, but I try to be pretty, I try to be less suspicious of tap water, but these Camelback bottles I think are really the greatest thing in the world for food or for water. The food thing though, I have there's a couple of key rules that I have for food. One is that anything that I've purchased somewhere else and taken home has to be eaten within 24 hours.
I'm very close to violating that rule at the moment as we speak.
Yeah. And you just picked up that food that's the day old Kung Pao, right?
I didn't say when, but I was describing to you before the show. I ordered some Chinese food yesterday because I'd gotten home from PAX and I was exhausted and I just wanted some food. So I ordered some Chinese food from a place I've never ordered it before, and I was expecting the normal takeout containers, and they were these styrofoam flats with massive amounts of food. So I now have two styrofoam flats plus a soup, and I'm trying to consume them within a reasonable amount of time, three meals a day.
Okay. See, that's okay then.
I mean, I typically have about 2.5 meals a day. So I took it to work today and I'll have it for dinner. So
yeah, my rule of thumb for that though is Asian food. Like Chinese food, pretty much. If I don't have it, if I don't finish it for that meal, I gotta have it gone by the next one.
Wow!
I don't know. I'm super paranoid about that.
I love having leftover Chinese food or leftover pizza or something like that around.
Pizza is another one that has to be 24 hours because it gets everything goes wrong with pizza.
And this is even point. With proper refrigeration and all that.
Even
stuff?
With proper refrigeration.
What about freezing?
Freezing is a little bit different. I'm okay freezing stuff if it's, if I bring it home from the store frozen, a tuna steak or something, that can go right in there and that can last for weeks. But for things that I put in the freezer to freeze them, if they've been cooked, they've got to go pretty quick or they're going to get freezer burned, right?
Right. So go ahead.
I was just going to say, if it's something that I've made myself, it's got to be... It has to be eaten or thrown out within 72 hours. Now, if for some reason something has not left the refrigerator within that 72 hours, I'll probably not touch it for a month. So you know, it's not necessarily that I'm afraid of food getting moldy, because I'll let things, you know, I don't know about you, but I things will go wild.
Science experiments?
Yeah, yeah. Like, I think there's one container in the fridge right now that has been there for, I want to say, 2 months.
And is that just because you're too afraid to take it out, or?
Well, yeah, yeah. After that week, I was like, oh, I should have thrown that away. And then I'm like, oh, it's going to be nasty. So I just leave it. And then
you have no one to blame but yourself there. Yeah.
Yeah. Either Liz will rescue me, or I will, you know, grow a pair and crack the lid and empty it out. But if you let it go long enough, and I'm just telling you this as a professional, if you as a professional procrastinator, if you let the food stay in there long enough, it will pass over the point where it's disgusting and stinks and become a more neutral pile of mold that doesn't really have a lot to it.
Yeah, but I mean, the part where I and this is not scientific or anything, but the part where it stinks has to be like stinking up the rest of your food, right?
You'd think so. But if you have enough of those little boxes of baking soda, I don't know. Like, there are some times where it gets a little dicey. I'm not the greatest person about cleaning the fridge, but food, if it's going to be eaten, has to be eaten within that 72 hours or less. And that's just good hygiene, you know, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Just like keeping food in your refrigerator for months. That's
Clearly, I'm super concerned about this. But yeah, it's that's more of a laziness issue than a food paranoia issue.
Right.
When it comes to leaving things in there for a while. But
go ahead.
No, I just, you know, I was thinking, like, the thing that bothers me the most about the advancement of technology in general is that a lot of the stuff that I think could really benefit from some new innovation doesn't really seem to receive a lot of attention. Like, I would like to have some sort of, like, I'm not saying cryogenics, but some sort of, like, super deep freeze or some method of, like, preserving food that's a little bit better than, like, saran wrap and keeping it at, you know, 50 degrees.
Well, just figure out what's in those Twinkies and just add that.
Yeah. Well,
I guess it's more of a lack of. If you've got nothing nutritious in your food, it actually will not spoil for quite a while.
Yeah, and I try really hard too. Like, I've been trying to be really good about cooking more lately, and Liz also, like, we've been trying to, like, prepare large meals, especially on the weekends, and then have stuff to take into lunch. So, like, next week, or last week rather, Sunday night we had breakfast for dinner. So I made I do this thing where I take eggs and vegan cheese and turkey bacon.
Wow.
So not vegan cheese because we're vegan, but vegan cheese because it's no dairy. And then some turkey bacon. And what you do is you cook the bacon, and then you tear it up into, like, little tiny pieces. And then you put it in with the eggs when you're making the eggs, and you fold it over, like, omelet style, and you serve it on toast with butter and garlic. And it's delicious. And it's like this big cheesy egg bacon sandwich. It's
nice.
Delicious.
Yeah.
And then the upside is that then you have, like, all this extra bacon. So for, like, the next 3 days, we had, like, you know, turkey clubs at lunch, and it was delicious.
Very good.
So, yeah, and I'm trying to be good about that. So then, like, tonight, for example, I made, like, this I don't really make it, but, like, I get this this jarred curry. I can't remember who makes it, but it basically, like, they call them simmer sauces. And they have, like, you know, coconut milk and coconut milk and red pepper and something else. And you get that, and you get some chicken, and you simmer the sauce, and you dump on the chicken, and you make some rice. Now, I have a rice maker, and it was like a $25 rice maker that I got at Bed Bath & Beyond in Rhode Island, like, a million years ago. So I'm surprised it's lasted this long, but it recently died. So I've got to go on Amazon and, like, find a proper rice cooker. But I don't have the wherewithal to invest heavily in the super-duper – I just flew in from Tokyo with this amazing rice cooker. Have you seen? There are some amazing.
Zojirushi, I've heard.
That's the one people usually mention. But there are some very nice, very fancy rice cookers on the market. But the one that I had before was, like, super basic. But I'll try to get something a little, you know, somewhere in between if I can this time. But because I cannot manage making rice in a pot. Like, tonight I burned rice. And from the time that the water started to boil, I stir it. I put the lid back on it. I lower the heat just to keep it simmering. And within 5 minutes, it's like burning. And I don't even know how I can possibly screw this up, but I manage to wreck rice on a regular basis. So a rice cooker is kind of a requirement for me, I think.
All right. So shifting gears a little bit. So that's sort of homemade food, but what about store-bought foods? How much does a sell-by date freak you out?
Sell-by is terrifying.
I know.
It's like, we got to get this off the shelves.
And then you have no idea what the window is.
Yeah.
Past that.
It is an absolutely insidious plan. because then there's me who will buy something and then I don't even notice that it's a sell-by. And so I'm looking at, I pick up the jar of yogurt that I got last week or whatever. And it's like, sell by this date. And I'm like, well, when the hell am I supposed to eat it by? Like, how long does anything keep? So we have this little chart because I can't remember. Liz's grandmother had this on the fridge. This was at Nana's house on the fridge. And it's called the Food Keeper. And I believe it was like a brochure that the Food and Drug Administration put out many, many years ago. And it's kind of like the Bible in our house because it's like it's mounted to the refrigerator with a big, thick magnet. And you can thumb through it and it tells you like how long food keeps.
Wow.
And then I usually take whatever that manual says and then I subtract a couple days from it.
just to be safe.
I'm not, who am I showing off for? So there's but the sell-by dates have to be like the worst thing in the world because, it's like you said, like I don't know how long something like that's supposed to keep or anything they put that date on. It's just, the date that they wanted to get it out of the store for whatever reason.
So even a Best Buy date, though, is a little freaky because, I'll let you in on a secret. It's not like exactly on that date the thing turns.
Oh, are you sure?
Yeah. I mean,
it's not like self-destruct sequence? is the milk program from the factory?
I mean, I will completely admit to until I actually considered this and, thought about it recently in the past few months, I think, was when I finally realized this, to thinking, on that date something happens and then you don't eat it anymore. No, it's constantly decomposing.
Yes. And it's like, and I watch a lot of Hoarders because it's one of the best shows on television. And I have some hoarding tendencies. Like I'm a bit of, I am absolutely a pack rat at the very least. And I will very rapidly acquire and just collect things over time, and I have a really hard time throwing things out. So it's really good for me, I think, to watch a show like Hoarders because my Saturday routine is usually I'll get up Saturday morning and then I'll walk into my home office and I'll be working on whatever is I'm going to work on that day, and then at some point I'll put on an episode of Hoarders and I'll clean. But usually it's not so much like walking around the house and cleaning. I mean, that does happen occasionally. But really what it comes down to is like me sorting through crap that I have in boxes in the home office. So I've been trying to like kind of figure out what I can get rid of and what I can keep and what I can move out of plain view and box up. Like I've got a bunch of movies I've been like encoding so that I can get the DVD boxes out of the living room, things like that. But watching Hoarders is very therapeutic and it's very motivational, I think, if you have a hard time. If you have a hard time, motivating yourself to straighten up, it's a pretty good way to go. But the thing on Hoarders, though, and it's like the exact opposite of the, of me throwing things out, are the people that keep their food forever. And like there was this one woman in particular who will not throw anything away if it's not puffy.
Oh,
so like they're digging through her refrigerator, and it's like they're grabbing all these containers that are like 6 months to a year or more that the food is like Best Buy a year ago. And she's like, oh, it's fine. And they're like, this is probably not fine. And she's like, well, it's not puffy. It's like, excuse me? She's like, the container will get puffy. And he's like, do you know how much bacteria has to be in a jar before it will puff out? Like that is really disgusting. And maybe my short views on food being thrown out is probably just because I live in constant fear of eating. I have a sick phobia. So any food that I think might cause me to be ill, I want to get rid of.
Uh-huh. Speaking of which, I did not get ill at PAX. They say the PAX pox is pretty common, but did not happen.
Well, you still have time.
Yeah, yeah, it could still hit me. We'll see. Anyway, all right. Well, speaking of throwing things out, you may be throwing out your PC pretty soon, right?
Well, so, you know, it's funny because I knew you were going to give me a hard time about this because we were talking before the show and you're like, really, do you want to talk about this? Because I've actually been thinking a lot about the Apple post-PC thing. And a lot of people that write about this are kind of, you know, tongue-in-cheek about it too. And I think there's a lot of people that are kind of missing the point with it. And, you know, people that work in my industry or just in general information technology find it really hard to believe that there will ever be a time where there's, you know, not a computer on your desk. And that's just the tool that they use. And that's not what this is about. Like the post-PC thing has nothing to do with what you're going to have on your desk. Or if you work with, you know, managing technology, like you're going to be using something to do that, right? But what the post-PC story, I think, is more about Apple's strategy in, you know, with iCloud, and I know it's not out yet, but from what we've seen about it and what the press has been saying and the articles and everything that's available, there's a couple of really big changes that it brings. And one of them is that you can walk into an Apple store and buy an iPod or an iPhone or an iPad, and you would never have to plug it into a computer. And all of your contacts and your documents that you're currently working on, TV, movies, music, everything can be somewhat transient. And like if you lose a device like your phone or your iPod, you could go into an Apple store and pick up another one and put in your account information and all your stuff is available again. And that's a pretty big deal. And that's something that I don't think anybody else is going to be able to present to end users, especially as tightly knit as Apple will be able to deliver it. So I think the post-PC world is not necessarily one without computers. It is the very real possibility of someone that doesn't need a computer still using things like an iPhone or an iPod and digital media on the web in order to make their lives better without ever having to touch a computer. And I think that's a really big deal. Like, not only do you not need to have a computer to provision the device and to use it, but there's also, I think, and this is kind of thinking a little bit further out, if I look at the iPhone, there are, in some cases, pretty compelling stories for people to just use an iPod. Like, I think it's entirely likely that, certainly in our lifetime, the cellular phone as a concept will probably kind of evaporate. Like, I think the way it's going right now is they're starting to figure out how to do all of these types of voice calls and things like that over VoIP. So using IP as the mechanism to deliver and route phone calls. And then not
a lot of big companies are already doing that for all their internal stuff.
Yep. And the backbone, like, you know, the AT&T backbone is starting to convert that way too. It's not so much running on, you know, copper and tip and ring right now. It's all being migrated to IP. So, you know, that legacy system can be overlaid on top of IP. And then for people that have fairly ubiquitous Wi-Fi, like I live in a college town that if I lived like on campus, I would have 24/7 internet access no matter where I go during the day.
Yep.
Like I wake up in the morning, go to school, go to class, go to work, come home, same network, same device. I probably would not even need to have a phone, especially. And I was going to say, like, you know, Skype and other services like that make that a very real possibility. And I think that people might not realize that the whole post-PC era could be a lot bigger than they might realize.
So what happened is, so this past week we had the news that Steve Jobs is resigning from CEO of Apple, and he is arguably the person or one of the few people who sort of designed or instigated what could be the post-PC era, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, he's kind of been the iCloud stuff was announced, what was it, like May or June, and he wasn't even really, he was on medical leave then, and the acting CEO was already, now I'm totally drawing a blank on his name.
Tim Cook?
Yes, thank you.
Yep.
Tim was already running the show since, you know, January or whatever. But I do think that, you know, Steve Jobs definitely set the stage for all of this, and like his aesthetic and his ideal and the things that he finds beautiful about technology were going to be, you know, getting rid of computers, I think, is probably a big part of that. I think that as a communications tool, the iPhone is fantastic. But yeah, I think Apple's in a very unique position to be able to deliver something that nobody else can, and that is a complete end-to-end experience that, you know, they're the service provider.
So for me, this scenario seems really convincing, and where it breaks down are the edge cases. So maybe you don't have a cellular connection. You're doing everything over Wi-Fi and voice over IP, and you're on a college campus and everything is great, but then there's that case where you're walking from building to building and the connection can't keep up between the various Wi-Fi hotspots, and the call gets dropped.
That particular instance, if you're on the same network, that's not supposed to happen. And I think that as that network becomes more important, people invest in that infrastructure more. And I think it will naturally resolve itself in terms of Wi-Fi coverage for large campuses and things like that. I thought you were going to go, you know, what if you want to leave town?
Yeah. I mean, that I was starting with a simple or a not a very large leap edge case. But yeah, what if you want to get on an airplane? Get on an airplane is fine.
Here's the thing. Like, you know, if you really think about it, they could probably do that already just with data contracts. Like, you know, think about how much money. Like, did you see that AT&T and Verizon are all, like, raising their text messaging rates again?
I saw something about, like, one of them's making it mandatory to get an unlimited texting package, right?
It is so stupid. So it is the biggest con job in the industry right now. Like, it takes first of all, a lot of people are of the impression that, like, text messaging uses data. And it does only in the sense that eventually it becomes a zero and a one and gets sent somewhere. But the text messaging stuff usually takes place over the voice channel, at least in the GSM side. I don't know about the CDMA part, but on a GSM network, text messages are sent on the voice channel, and they use such a small fraction of the voice channels required for making a phone call that they should be paying you to use text messaging instead of talking to each other. I'm not exaggerating. It takes far more spectrum for you to call somebody than it does for you to send.
Sure. Yeah.
100 messages.
Again, so, PAX example, you could get text messages through just fine, but no way you're making a phone call at a convention like that.
And same thing with the last week at the earthquake on the East Coast. A lot of the, like, I know in DC, text messaging was the way to go. On September 11th in 2001, the only device that I had that was, like, reliable for communication was the old Moby text CDPD style BlackBerry pager unit.
Wow.
Like the newer, quote unquote, the fancy BlackBerries with their cell phones built in were all SOL.
Wow.
Anything that you needed a cell service was pretty much not gonna work. But you know, I think that you could theoretically, if Apple wanted to have like an iPod that you could put a 3G SIM card into and just get a data plan. Because think about it. They're already laying the groundwork for this because they have this iMessage thing, right? So you'd be able to do text messaging.
Yeah. I messaged you earlier today.
Yeah. And they're already working on that. And they've already got a lot of the stuff is already in place for them to facilitate, you know, video chat, things like that, or any data connection. I think it's possible that getting a voice plan and a text messaging plan from your mobile operator will be something that a really quaint idea for really terrible old devices. I think it's very soon, and I think that consumers, especially with the stupid, you have to spend, I think it's like a $10 a month plan, or you're paying like a nickel a message, something just completely
ridiculous. It's usually 10 or 20 cents. Yeah,
so stupid. And like, they are completely screwing people, and it's not even, it's like, I don't think people realize like just how big of a con it is. Like, a lot of people are like, oh, you know, as a phone company, they'll do anything. And, oh, the damn phone company. And people like to complain about all the nickel and dime taxes. But a service like this, it is a complete joke that they're charging.
You know, when text messaging first started, I remember a lot of people saying, yeah, this is such a ripoff. Why would anybody use this? You can just call the person and it's basically free on your minutes. Why would you ever use texting? And then people realized that texting was actually really useful. And then all of a sudden, all the complaints about this is a complete ripoff kind of died away, just because the usefulness is great enough to justify the cost for most people.
Sure. I you know what? Like, I'm on board.
Yeah.
I love text messaging. I use it all the time. It's great. However, you know, with iMessage, I think it's very likely that the majority of people I spend a lot of time trading text messages with are also using iOS devices, by and large. I think, you know, there's going to be some BlackBerry people, and I might know someone that's stricken with a WebOS thing or something. I don't know, but I think it's very likely that, or an Android device, I guess. So I probably have a lot of people that use those. But, you know, I'd say at least half people I talk to are probably on an iPhone.
Yeah.
So, you know, it will prefer to route those types of messages to those users over that connection. So the cell network will never even see it, which is great. But I have to wonder, like, if they're hip to this yet, that their days are numbered. Because It's gonna happen where, I mean, especially with like the LTE transition, like why would I pay $50 a month or whatever for voice when I can do VoIP over an IP connection? So if I could pay the cell phone company, if my monthly bill to AT&T was reduced to just data, it would be, you know, $30 for unlimited 3G or whatever. That's a very different bill than the $150 a month I'm paying now.
Yeah. At the end of the day, though, if people want both voice and data and are willing to pay a certain amount for both voice and data, then the carriers are going to charge that certain amount for both voice and data. It doesn't matter if it's all going over the data connection or not. They're going to find a way to charge. Either you charge that for the data connection or you charge them separately somehow. But as long as people are willing to pay that for those services, then they're probably still going to cost that.
They've got to really figure out. Someone needs to like make this some like ad hoc a la carte system. So I think it's gonna come soon, like within the next, I say, 2 years, 2 or 3 years, 2 years,
or five.
I think it'll be sooner than that. But I think not the iPhone 5, but the one after that, I think will probably be available as a VoIP device that doesn't need a cell contract.
Yeah, I could see that.
Like a pay-as-you-go data plan. Because the mobile operators have been, I mean, they've been screwing themselves for years. All they've done is stand in their own way. And, you know, Apple's kind of like forced them to become kind of a utility. And they wanted to be content providers, and they wanted to be merchants, and they wanted to be storefronts.
Oh, I remember the days of on-phone mobile operator branded stores where you buy your ringtones and things like that.
You know, people still do that, dude.
Oh, I know. Well, on a lot of old
like
phones,
feature phones. No, yeah. even new feature phones do that kind of.
But on a lot of those phones, you press almost any button on the phone, and you are directed.
Yeah.
to a carrier operated
WAP site that they bill you $2 to even open your browser to go to.
Right. Right.
Yeah, they're total scumbags. So they've been delivering a really terrible service and charging a lot of money for it, and forcing people into these really terrible decisions, and I think people aren't going to be sympathetic. Like, you know, AT&T wants to buy T-Mobile; they want that spectrum. Part of me wants to say go screw it, just because I want them to be holding a bigger bag when the day comes. But you know, it's Al Franken hates that. He sent an email, not you know just to me, but he's got a mailing list that I'm on, and he's like, "This is why the AT&T T-Mobile deal is bad for consumers," and he's got kind of a good point.
I recently watched an AT&T branded YouTube video about that deal, and it was very optimistic about it.
Yeah, what'd they say?
I mean, it was all about spectrum. It was about AT&T explains spectrum to you, and talking about how there is potentially enough spectrum, but it takes a long time for all the stuff to go through the FCC, basically. Yes. And in the meantime, they want to get more spectrum another way.
that was the email that I wrote back to Al Franken that I'm sure that nobody read, which was basically, you know, you wouldn't have to worry so much about maintaining competition in the marketplace if you made it easier for people to license spectrum.
Right.
Because the way they do it now is stupid. And like that whole auction process is dumb. And it's, you know, the whole notion of artificial scarcity on airwaves, I don't really buy into it. Hmm. It's my inner libertarian kicks in pretty hard when it comes to the FCC.
Well, the airwaves are public property, so.
No, they're government property.
Yeah, I mean, that is.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And I think it leads to a lot of problems. Like the reason that we've had, you know, pretty crappy cell coverage in the United States is because, you know, you can't have the same density that you can in Europe.
Hmm. Yeah. All right, let's see. We are winding down the show here, but we got a couple more things you wanted to mention. The first is something that I still don't understand. Something about Chromium and Chromatic. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so the Google Chrome browser, there's some people that are really paranoid about it because they don't want Google to, like, I don't know. They think that Google's, like, setting up spy cameras in their toilet or something. But there's also the Chromium open source Chrome browser, which is basically just like a stripped down Chrome. So if you like that engine and it's fast, and it is fast and it's pretty nice, there's this Chromium browser branch you can use. And there's like these nightly builds, and there's an application for the Mac called Chromatic that you can get on Mac Update. That's my go-to site for finding software.
Not version and, tracker?
No, screw version tracker. So I go to Mac Update, and here's why. If you type in anything after macupdate.com, it'll search for it. So if you go to like macupdate.com/Chrome and hit enter, it will return a search page of all the stuff that matches Chrome.
Wow. What if there's an actual directory on Mac Update that...
I've only hit that like once, and it was like backup or something like that.
Okay.
I got like a backup archive directory, and I sent the dude an email. This was like 3 years ago, and I was, or 4 years ago, and I was like, you might want to hide this directory. But yeah, there was... but usually it's... I mean, I'm sure there's a couple more out there you could find, but I've only hit it the once. But... it's great, and it pulls a nightly build of Chromatic and installs it for you, and then you have the latest and greatest Chrome browser. So if you're kind of a Chrome nerd, I've been playing with it a little bit lately. My biggest problem with it at first was that I don't have the Safari hotkeys, so I couldn't activate things on the bookmark bar in Chrome, because if you hit like Command-1 in Safari, it'll go to the first bookmark in your bookmarks bar.
Right.
But if you do that in Chrome, it'll go to the first tab. So it's like, you know, 1, 2, and 3, and 4 are all tabs in Chrome. So I had to install this add-on called Shortcut Manager.
Is that just a Chrome add-on, or is that a system-wide thing?
It's just for Chrome. It's a Chrome extension. And my hotkey for you know, Quix, my little bookmarklet that lets me do everything.
Yep.
It's like the one bookmark I need. I made that QQ. So if I'm like, if I'm reading a website or an article or something, and I want to read it later in Instapaper, I just type QQ on the keyboard and a little box pops up, and I type RL and I hit enter, and it kicks it off to Instapaper so I can read it later.
Nice.
Yeah. So that's pretty handy. The other thing was I was taking a look at something called Jekyll, and it is I use WordPress for a couple of my websites, show.helia.com for one, but it's not something I really get into too much, and every time I log in, there's like, you know, 5 things that have to be updated, and usually it's because there's some sort of exploit for it,
right?
And there's like shady add-ons.
Several WordPress blogs hacked about a year back, yeah.
Yep, and like, you know, weird JavaScript include nonsense, and it's such a pain in the neck. And I was looking around at what my options were, and I came across this thing called Jekyll, and it's written in Ruby, and what you do is you basically use Jekyll as like a printing press of sorts. So I was able to export all the content from a couple of my WordPress sites into Jekyll. And the way that I did that is through a Python script called ExitWP for Exit WordPress. And it's some freeware package out there, and it's a little Python script. It has like 2 dependencies. And when you run it, you just tell it what you want, and it'll dump things out into whatever format. And I used ExitWP and told it I was moving to Jekyll, so it like migrated all my junk into Markdown.
Nice.
So all of my web content was nice and neatly organized into posts formatted in Markdown. So I really like that. And you know what? We should talk next week about proprietary data formats and why they suck. And this trend that is going on right now where people are moving to plain text files, which I think is awesome.
Yeah, sure.
I think that's a really good topic. And what's great about it, though, is with Jekyll, I basically can just write the text in whatever editor I want, and then I run it through Jekyll, and Jekyll, like some, you know, 1800s era printing press, starts going to work and like converting Markdown into HTML, and it does includes, and it basically gives you the appearance of like a dynamically generated site. Like I moved heyemery.com is now running through Jekyll, and it's not really much different than it was before because I don't really do a whole lot with it, but I have like a little QA site for Kvetch, qa.kvetch. kvetch. And that's like some stuff that I've moved over, and I'm still kind of playing around with the style sheets and everything because it's definitely a different look than I have right now, but I like it a lot. I think it's a real joy to work with, and I also feel like I know every piece of my website instead of having like half of it be this like convoluted mass of wires behind my desk I don't quite understand. So yeah.
And behind the scenes, what you're interacting with on a daily basis is basically just folders of text files, right?
Yeah. So I just have like this folder on my computer that I synchronize. I could put it in Dropbox, but I use ArrowFS, and I've been playing with that. I can talk about that some other time too. But it's kind of like Dropbox, but instead of syncing to the cloud, quote unquote, it's using a peer-to-peer technology to sync between all of my computers. So like my desktop at home and my desktop at work and my MacBook Air are all kind of like chatting with each other and keeping this directory in sync.
Wow.
But it's pretty great. But Jekyll's great for that because, yeah, I write things out as text files, and then I run Jekyll and I push them to my web server with rsync.
So it does require a bit of technical knowledge to set up and keep going, right?
You do need a pretty thick Unix beard right now to make good use of it. But I think it's something that's getting a lot of attention. There's a kit called Octopress that doesn't require a whole lot of nerdery, and it's like a preset, pre-canned Jekyll instance with a blog type theme already included. So you could probably take a look at Octopress, and I think most people that are working with WordPress, like their own WordPress installs, not like the WordPress.com or WordPress.org site.
Yep.
I think a lot of people would probably be able to figure it out, but it's not smooth sailing one click wonder yet, but I think it'll get there. Or not. Like, I think people will probably end up using Jekyll to make other tools. So I think, you know, you could probably create a nice, you know, printing press widget that takes Markdown and you drop it onto that, like drag and drop, and have it dump out a pressed out document. Things like that, I think, could probably be where it goes, but hopefully it'll take off. There's people, I guess it powers all the GitHub pages. So all the people that use GitHub may or may not know it, but they're using Jekyll when they're doing their GitHub pages.
Cool. So are we going to switch over to that for show.hellyeah.com?
Not right now. I'm not in a huge hurry for it. You could, but...
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with WordPress at the moment, especially since the PodPress plugin makes it so easy to do all the iTunes podcast stuff.
I will say this. Yeah, the PodPress thing is awesome, but the what's nice about Jekyll is that when you don't have to run like a big monstrous MySQL database,
yeah,
things get a lot faster. Like qa.kvetch loads in like less than half the time that the WordPress site takes. And I've got the WordPress one I'm using the Supercache plugin and Cloudflare. Mm. And it's still twice as fast to load the one that got printed out from Jekyll.
Yeah. Yep.
It's pretty sweet.
I switched a couple of WordPress blogs over to just static pages because I really didn't need the WordPress. It was just there, so it made it easier for me to edit. But hey,
and that's all Jekyll does, right? Like you just feed it. You know, you take your Markdown or your textile or HTML or plain text, and then you run Jekyll against it, and it puts out an HTML static site that just happens to have some of the features that you're familiar with on larger dynamically generated sites. But yeah, I think you know, I've done plenty of things with just you know. Who hasn't had a plain HTML hello world page?
Yep. Yeah, although I've had people ask me, is HTML hard to learn? There's plenty of people still out there.
There's also people that, you know, still think that Dreamweaver is amazing.
I was blown away by the fact that Dreamweaver could put a div element anywhere on a page. That was incredible to me.
Yeah. Yep. I don't know.
That was in like the, I don't know, 2000 or so, somewhere around there.
Yeah, I think the first time I ever used Dreamweaver, and that was probably around 2000 or something like that. And it's also the last time I used Dreamweaver. I've never really needed it, and part of that is that I don't do web stuff. You know, like what I do is just write and then publish it online. Like I don't do anything really.
You don't have to web development.
No. So, you know, it's never been something that I've needed. So I say things like, you know, everyone's done a Hello World HTML page. And, you know, obviously not everyone has, but people that work with making web pages probably have.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair bet.
So, I mean, it's yeah. But I think, you know, publishing online is one of those things that it's going to get different. I don't know how, but
sure.
This everyone coming back to semantic editing and using things like Markdown is pretty interesting to me. Yep.
All right. Well, that will pretty much do it for this episode of the Hell Yeah Show. No Star Trek this week. It's all Emery's fault.
Yep.
Every bit Emery's fault.
You're welcome.
We've got good plans for next week, though. We're gonna do something potentially with the original series. We'll see how that goes. So
yeah, I got to pick an episode, I think.
Yep. Other than that, I think we are finished up here. This has been episode 5 of the Hell Yeah Show. If you want to email us, the email is show@hellyeah.com. And Emery, where can they check us out online?
http://show.hellyeah.com.
And those are backslashes, right?
Yes. Wait, is the backslash the one that goes to the
I
left?
Never know. I'm pretty... I think
slashes.
So, because it starts forward and it goes back, right?
Yeah, they're forward slashes.
Those aren't... No.
The one on the question mark
is
a forward slash.
Really?
The backslash is the one under that you share with a pipe key.
I don't know. But the stroke starts at the top of the slash, right?
No.
No?
Are you kidding me? Are you serious?
I'm kidding. No, I'm not kidding you. I always mess these two up.
The backslash is the one that is on the same key as the pipe. That's a back.
All right. I'll take you for your word on that.
Your daytime intern employer would be horrified if they didn't know that when you're logging into a domain that you thought you were typing a forward slash.
Yeah, they call it a whack, actually. So
do they really?
Yeah, they really do.
That's kind of awesome. I've never heard that.
Yep. All right.
You know, like bang oh. and
yeah. All right, this has been the Hell Yeah Show.
Episode 5.
Running all along this week without Star Trek, so we'll cut it back down to an hour next week. Don't you worry. Show.hellyeah.com is the place to go. We will see you next Monday.
See ya.